the psychoanalytical frame I have, and I have in those fields in myself, helps me just to find a way not to go too near and not to be too distant to persons. It is naturally a very, very other thing than the one we learn when we learn to be perhaps a psychoanalyst. Then we have the opportunity to feel a little bit in a room where we are not in danger. And it's more the patient that's in danger. He is coming and he has fears. But we, knowing our room, our couch, our etc., we don't have many fears. But if you work as I did, and I didn't know before, work in an open field, in different houses, in different hospitals, in different orphanage houses, you are first full of fear and at the same time also very curious what happens, what can happen. It's not the same as if you are in your own practice, not at all the same. And one of the most important things is that with my psychoanalytical setting in myself, not in the room in which I work, I can find a way that doesn't make too much fear to the patient and at the same time perhaps find some ways to getting nearer to him, to his inner problems, than when I would be just a friend or a psychologist or a religious woman.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Barbara Segesser. Dr. Segesser is a training analyst with the Swiss Psychoanalytical Society, and she is a member of the IPA. But our conversation today is not about her work in Switzerland. It's about her work in East Africa. I learned about her work from a chapter she wrote entitled 15 Years of Psychoanalytical Fieldwork in Eastern African Cities. And this chapter is from a book that's entitled Trauma, Flight, and Migration, Psychoanalytic Perspectives. It is a book in the IPA in the Community book series, which I am honored to say I'm the book series editor. But the credit for this volume belongs first and foremost to the 18 contributors who wrote chapters that give you a really hands-on feel for what it's like to think and work and use one's analytic sensibility in refugee circumstances far off the couch. The credit for this volume also belongs to the four editors who really poured their heart and soul into this effort. I was aware of how deeply they cared about this work and how hard and long they worked for it. The four editors are Vivian Elton, Marianne Leusinger-Bolivar, Gertrude Schlesinger-Kipp, and Vivian Pender. And hats off to them for this effort. It's a really deep experience about how one can be an effective psychoanalyst in settings, as I say, far off, far from the couch. In our conversation today, Barbara and I talk about her work in remarkably difficult circumstances with people who, as she characterizes them, have a sensibility that is in some ways the opposite of a psychoanalytic one. We discuss the meaning of the Quran in their life and how she engages with that. We talk about women who have experienced genital mutilation and what it's been like for her to work with them. It's a profound look at work that doesn't make it to our journals often, doesn't make it to our institutes often, but is a piece of what psychoanalysis is about. And it's not just her chapter. I can't recommend this book highly enough. One could have chosen many other contributors and many other chapters to highlight. They really give you a feel for how broadly a psychoanalytic way of thinking can engage one with people, as I say, far from the consulting room. Here is my conversation with Dr. Barbara Segesser. Barbara, welcome to the podcast. I'm so pleased you're able to be here. Barbara, the title of this podcast is Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. And the Off the Couch segment is designed to bring forward the many analysts who bring their clinical and analytic sensibilities to clinical settings outside the consulting room. But I don't think off the couch is the best way to characterize your work. And I take my lead for this from the title of a chapter that you've written in this book. Your chapter title is called 15 Years of Psychoanalytical Fieldwork in Eastern African Cities. And when I read and reread this chapter, there was something about your use of the term fieldwork that spoke to me. It's not simply that you're working in the field outside the consulting room, but you're working in a psychological field that is very unusual for psychoanalysts to be working in. And I thought the best way that I can share this with our listeners is to read some introductory excerpts from your chapter, which gives an overview of the kind of work you're doing. And then I'm going to ask you to tell us about it in your own spontaneous words. But to start us off, let me read the following, and this is a quote. I have gained much experience with young orphans, older war orphans, people threatened by hunger and fear, and those gravely marked by psychosomatic suffering. At the same time, I learned to treasure in a new way my psychoanalytic concepts and clinical experience that also built the essential basis for my work in Eastern Africa. I am confronted by the most alarming forms of psychic and psychosomatic illnesses and disease and near-death experiences. I have started to realize that in many places, psychology is hardly known and not at all practiced. I am bringing something foreign to a particular culture or ethnic group. The individual subjective psyche is predominantly ignored in many Eastern African political, religious cultures and ethnic groups. Close quote. Barbara, that's quite a description. That is at such variance with where we generally live conceptually and clinically. Tell us about what that's like. And then I'm going to ask you what you mean when you say, I've learned to treasure in a new way my psychoanalytic and concepts and clinical experience.
Thank you, Harvey, for this introduction and this question. Well, first, I did learn to see that my way to speak with human is another one than other people do. The psychoanalytical concept, the psychoanalytical frame I have, and I have in those fields in myself, helps me just to find a way not to go too near and not to be too distant to persons. It is naturally a very, very other thing than the one we learn when we learn to be perhaps a psychoanalyst. Then we have the opportunity to feel a little bit in a room where we are not in danger, and it's more the patient that's in danger. He is coming and he has fears. But we, knowing our room, our couch, our etc., we don't have many fears. But if you work as I did, and I didn't know before, work in an open field, in different houses, in different hospitals, in different orphanage houses, you are first full of fear. And in the, at the same time, also very curious what happens, what can happen. It's not the same as if you are in your own practice, not at all the same. And one of the most important things is that with my psychoanalytical setting in myself, not in the room in which I work, I can find a way that doesn't make too much fear to the patient, and at the same time perhaps find some ways to get in nearer to him, to his inner problems, than when I would be just a friend or a psychologist or a religious woman. This is a big difference.
You describe it very beautifully, how your internalized psychoanalytic sensibility, perhaps is the word, allows you to be with the person as a person. That is, you may notice your fear, you may notice others' fears, but you can sit with it and be with them and help them know that you are sitting with it. And that offers an opportunity between the two of you. Am I characterizing what you're saying correctly?
Yes, thank you. This is very correct this way. And I think the word psychoanalytical sensibility is better than the one I did find. Since German English is not my mother tongue, I sometimes have to look for words.
You describe how different the mindset is, and you're referring to Muslim refugees, and you're referring to Eastern Africa, and maybe we should start off by sharing with the audience what you shared with me, which is how different the community you worked with in Eastern Africa versus Western Africa, and how that difference asks something different of you. So tell us about that.
Well, I did work in Eastern Africa. Often people talk about and say, oh, Africa. But Africa is a huge country, and we have to separate the parts of the country. What I say about Western Africa are things I mainly have heard, or I have been but didn't work there, for instance, at Mali or other countries. The people there, especially in Senegal, they are most open for Western ideas, US ideas. They like to dance, they like to progress in their work, like they think Western community do. And Eastern Africa, the part of Africa from Alexandria down to the Indian Ocean. This is the most poor part of Africa. And the people, they are really very religious. They live in their religion. They say, Allah is here and Allah will help me. And I believe at Allah. And I think this religion is good to help people that are in a very bad situation. You know, they don't have enough to eat, not enough to drink. They cannot work because there is no work to do. It's really quite a big misery that's over the land. From Alexandria to Khartoum, where I was always, to Addis Ababa, to Djibouti, to Kampala, and finally to Zanzibar. The people in Eastern Africa are poor, but what they can make them rich is perhaps to think that they have Allah and Allah give them everything they like to have. And when I work psychoanalytically, it's almost this religion that gives the most intense resistance to my way to work. You know, Allah and what Allah does is written in the Quran. The Quran is like, for instance, with Christian people, the Bible. And the Quran is the book for everything in the life of a Muslim. Quran says how to marry, how not to marry, how to divorce, how to make children, how not to make children, how to eat, how not to eat, how to drink. For everything, there are rules or surahs. This is the name of the rules in the Quran. And if we read the Quran, or if I read the Quran, I can think there is no space for individual thinkings and feelings. Quran says this is and this is and this is, and people think that what Quran says goes this way and is really this way. My way is to see what pains people have. Because, you know, Quran says also, well, if you have got this and this pain, this is not a pity, you just make this and this, and then it's going away. And we psychoanalysts know it's not going away like a mechanic mechanism. We know that our soul does work in another way. And my way is then to find small ways to go to the real pain and to see where people are not good, where people are very depressed, and then understand that they are depressed. And this can help a little bit if the resistances are going away. That means if woman, for instance, living in Eastern Africa, has enough courage not to hear to Quran, but to hear to herself and what happens in her self and what she is would like to do and not what the Quran says.
Now, let me ask you about that, because that refers to the issue of a person's subjectivity. And you make the point that for some of these people, perhaps the majority, subjectivity is, these are my words, tell me if they're right, is inherently a heresy to listen to oneself and to not follow what the Quran or Allah is said to say or direct you, already puts you outside of the group. It makes you an other. And therefore dangerous to the group, therefore someone who can be seen as destructive to the group, and thereby perhaps worthy of being destroyed. Is this accurate?
Well, this is a danger, yes. We have here in Switzerland a man who did work much And many times in Africa, his name is Ziegler, and he did write books. And he once said, in Africa, you always have to be to pay attention that they don't think you are a colonialist. And that's what I saw also. When I came there, I thought, oh, nice. I can work here and I can tell how we can do things better, how we can make that orphans are better. But this is always a very, very difficult point. If you say, at least in Eastern Africa, what you think or what you did learn or how you do things, it goes perhaps 1 second and people can think, oh, colonialism, no thanks. And in this way, I am somehow in danger. But as I know that this happens, and as I am myself not a religion fanatic, I'm quite neutral, also because I'm a psychoanalyst, I can manage those problems when other peoples are very religious to some thinking. I think a person that is not neutral would have much more pain to talk with people, to help them, to understand them. It needs persons that are, one, very flexible, because I didn't know where I work one day or in the morning or in the afternoon with which patient. You must be very, very flexible. And this is possible for to work if you are in yourself enough structurized to be a psychoanalyst and to work in this way. This helps enormous.
That's that internal psychoanalytic sensibility we were referring to. Now, when you say that you people may be quick to characterize your efforts to be of help as a colonial focus, is it also misunderstood as if you're a missionary of some sort?
Well, the negative sense is always colonialist. Missionary, I don't think they are very against mission, but I don't like mission. This is clear. I'm sorry, I say this quite open, because missionary did like colonialist, but in another Schwerpunkt. They had another goal, but the goal was also to say these persons, these Eastern African human beings, how they have to live and what is evil and what is not evil. And this is a thing I don't do. And missionary did make many children, as we know now, and did say to the people that live there don't make sins, etc., etc. I don't like that.
The way you've characterized it to me is that you felt that the missionaries were just changing the book that one has to follow from the Quran to the Bible,
yes,
but didn't get to the point of helping the person learn to listen to their own experience.
Yes, this is very nice how you say it. Thank you. I am listening, or I try to listen to their own experience, and I can also, after I can show you when I speak about patients I had. And I think it is very important, but it makes me sometimes not to be very loved. For instance, when I did, when I was with ladies giving birth, 12 in one room, and the midwives did say to them, oh, your pain is only here because you didn't pray. And I then said to the midwives, look, stop with that. This is not true. They have terrible pains, and help them. When I say such things, I'm a little bit out of society, but I right. was with all those women that had terrible pains. I think it needs somebody that has courage, but knows where to say the things that are important to say and where not.
The way you write it, you say the following. In terms of how you're able to intervene in a helpful way, you say, quote, "I can try to provide them somehow a little freedom in their thinking that allows them to discover something very tiny that is new, that is found again, that can develop and grow." That is, it is both very modest and also monumental. And we know this from regular clinical work, that small changes of self-awareness are what we call game changers. I mean, it can open up a new life. And you very aptly and carefully say that, yes, this is something new, but of course it is not something new. It is something found again, because we were all born with it in some form until it was changed to fit our cultures and communities. I would imagine, and this is a question, I would imagine that the people you've worked with, where you have been able to engage them in this way, would become deeply attached to you. And if there are a number of things, I wish your chapter was itself a book, because there's so much more I'd like to learn. And one of the things I'd like to learn that I didn't see in your chapter was the nature of the attachments that these individuals had towards you, and how that lived for each of you and in furtherance of the treatment.
Yes, this is a very important question. I answer first by remarks that people did to me. They said, "Oh, what shall this bring if you go 3 times a year there and work with persons and then you go away? What shall this be? This is just nothing." And it is not nothing. There is attachment, but as I don't work every day or 4 times a week, but 1, 2, 3, 4 times with people, it is another sort of attachment. And they know from the beginning that I go away. Well, this cannot make that they are not attached, but it helps perhaps a little bit. One person, one man with whom I did work, and this is not very usual because Koran says that men are the first persons on the world, and then comes a woman, a child of a child, and a cat, and a dog, and a slave. And so if I, as a woman, work with a man, and I am a woman in the position of a psychoanalyst, it's somehow for Koran a queer situation. And I didn't know if it can help or not help. And the man first, when he came, he said, "The negative person is my wife. She doesn't do as Koran says. She wears her clothes not as Koran says. One can see her, the beginning of the hand." And the final session, when I told him, "Well, bye-bye, I go away now," he said, "It's a pity, I cannot work more with you. And I hope when you come back, you shall be a Muslima." This is very interesting how he turns the things. First he says, "When you come back," and then that I turn to his religion. So he could perhaps, without bad feelings, stay attached to me.
In other words, his affection for you was, in his mind, dangerously unbridled, and he tried to then make it more syntonic for his beliefs by saying, well, that would be okay, especially if you were a Muslim.
Yes. It's interesting. It's very interesting.
Yeah. You mentioned working with men. Most, if I understand you right, most of the work you've done has been with women.
Yes.
And especially women involved in maternity and women who've gone through horrific sexual trauma in their lives, in their refugee statuses. Can you give us some examples?
Well, in our country also, they are more the women that say, I don't go well. I feel bad. Men tend to, in Switzerland, to say, no, I'm fine. I'm extremely fine. Mm-hmm. So it's somehow the same thing in some African countries. The women are suffering a lot. And the women at the same time never say, I'm suffering because my husband is not good with me. They told me, even when I did work in maternity and I knew that the man or a woman did take drug the whole day, she said, oh, he is a wonderful man. He is good to me. Women tell this to protect themselves. Because if they say, my man is not good to me, they can be put at the pronger. They can be bad women then, and so they do not say that. After I did work in orphanages, but in orphanages I had to work also with women because they did look for the orphans. Then I went to the maternity hospital, a new hospital. I did work in neurology and with women that were going to give birth. And all these women were in physical and psychical state, because they were genitally mutilated. Some of those at the worst possible state, this is named pharaonically, like Pharaoh did.
Explain that? Yeah, I don't know what that
means. I explain it, yes. Their clitoris, their outer and inner labias were cut away, and the opening, the genital opening, is sewed together, and there is only left a small hole that blood and urine can pass. And the other women are also genitally mutilated in Eastern Africa. I think it's 60% or even more that are mutilated. And when a woman is mutilated, one is the fact as it is, the other is that all the field around the mutilation, the genital field, is becoming hard. There is any flexibility left that makes that when they give birth, they have really much more pains than a woman has usually. They have somehow terrible pains. And when I did work in this room several times, I did start a new thing. I did start to make a small massage to their feet, because plenty of these women do not speak English, nor French, nor Italian. They just speak their dialect, that's clear. And with this very small, very soft, very gentle massage to the feet, they began to feel better and better and better. I did make this massage because I know that touching the feet goes to the brain, directly to the brain. And these women were so happy then, and they did kiss my hand, also because I was a little bit hard with these midwives. They did kiss my hand and they said, oh, Allah will help you. your lifelong Allah will help you. And this was, I never had in my life such a touching echo to my work. This is perhaps one thing. I had often a very touching echo to my work because I could turn the negative death narcissism to life narcissism from people, and it was often very touching.
You know, it's perhaps an indirect route, but perhaps not. When to revisit the question of what is it you bring as a psychoanalyst to these settings, and I hear your answer as, I knew to massage these women's feet. Now, you may link it to the neurologic connection to the brain, and I don't doubt what you're saying, but what's clear to me is that you found a way to be with them, like we were saying before, to found a way to be with them, not too close and not too far, but mm-hmm. in a soothing way to, as you say, to transform the death narcissism into life through you, your sensibility, and their attachment to you, I would add, though it's perhaps not essential to add it, but there is something that's happening between you and them. You, I suspect, are the first person, if not the only person in their life, to ever give them any kind of massage, much less one in the midst of their painful childbirth. I can only imagine how meaningful that was to them.
Yes, thank you. I think so too. It was very meaningful because also for me, you know, these are not feet that are, they are treated with red lacquer. And so these are feet that are, well, how feet have been years ago in our country. And it is what they were really very touched. And me too, that I'm I sure. had found this method. What I also then did use with babies. And it was wonderful with babies too. Not touch the head. This is not right, good. This right. is too intimate. But touch the feet, that's a very good thing.
But let me ask you, while we're on the subject of your reactions to these women, it is well known for those of us who have worked with patients who have been traumatized that at times we, the clinician, will feel rage at the abuse that our patient has been subjected to, but the patient doesn't. Mm-hmm. The question is often, why am I the only person in the office who's angry at what just befell you? And I'm listening to what you're describing, and the mutilation, the genital mutilation, that is not only in the moment, but destroys so much of their life for the rest of their life. And you are there with them, and you see the result of that. Do you not feel rage?
Well, this is an important question. Look, I did feel rage already before because I did read about this. I was in a rage, yes. But when I'm with this woman, I don't think that I did feel rage. I felt more how they suffer and more the question, how can I at least do a little bit something good to him? This was perhaps my question. And then I did find the soft passage from the feet because there was not possible to talk with them. This was not possible. But I think to touch the feet can go with psychoanalysis. I think so.
So in a sense, you demonstrated for them the capacity to take what you're calling death narcissism and mm-hmm. turn it into a loving engagement that hopefully will be a model for them to internalize from you.
Yes, this is, you say it in a very good way. I can't say it myself because it's a problem of
Well, you're doing it. That's the important thing.
And I do the same thing when I work with other patients. For instance, the patient that nobody went near her because she was in her bed. They didn't even know if she speaks. They didn't even know if she is dead or not dead. And there I also did try to show them that there are ways to help, even if the situation seemed to be terrible. And this is somehow my way, yes, to see how can I a little bit help, in the sense to tell them you are a human being, you are worth to stay in life and worth to be helped.
You say it so beautifully. This is my way, you say. Can you share with us your way and how you've come to this? I mean, this is very unusual work. Can you give us with whatever degree of openness you are comfortable with, how do you get to be able, to do this and to be interested in doing this?
Well, I think only people that have had not a light life emotionally can do this. Only people that know that there were times in their life that they did think it's too hard for me. Then all those people, one time they say, I don't wish to do anymore, or they say, no. Now I try to make for other people perhaps life a little bit easier. This is one thing. The other thing is that I went to Alexandria many years ago, and I wanted to go there when I was 19 and had finished my school. I wanted to study there. And my father said, no, you can't go to study here. You have to study in Switzerland. Then I did stay in Switzerland, and only late I went to Alexandria. I wanted to go to Alexandria because I did read a book from Lawrence Durrell. The name is still Alexandria Quartet. It was a book from the 60s or 70s. And he did describe the town as a town full of eccentric artists in different ways, very, very different people, and very beautiful architecture and very beautiful street at the side of the sea. That's why I wanted to go there. And finally, I was there and wanted to have some days of holiday. And then I saw the first day when I went in the park to make a little walk, a couple, and beside of the couple, a cat, a red cat going with this couple. And the cat was very proud to be with this couple. And then I went to this couple. We were the only person in the park and did begin to talk with them. And I saw she was a English lady, he was from Alexandria. We did talk, and suddenly he had a phone call. And in this phone call, he was asked to go as a medical doctor with a convoy to an orphan's home. I said, oh, can I come with you? She said, no, sure, you won't. I said again, yes, I would like to come with you. He again said, no, that's nothing for you. I said again, I would like to come with you. Then he told me, look, if really you would like to come with me, make a phone tomorrow morning. I made this phone and I could go with them. And there I saw so much misery from children. There were old ladies that had gifts for the children, very, very kind. But there were children that wouldn't take those gifts. They turned away, they turned their head against just away from those ladies. And, you know, these were children, they never had a shirt or something, but they just wouldn't have anything more from those persons. And this was so impressing me that it became evident for me to go and to stay here and to work with orphans. This was my beginning of the work, to see the misery of others and to think it cannot be, it should be a little bit less. That's how I did start. And I had the chance to find in between 4 days medical doctors that it helped me, that it indicate me orphanages and so on. I always had some chance to find people with whom I could speak, talk in Addis, in Egypt, in Khartoum, everywhere. This is perhaps something that's not everybody has. I can talk with people from any other culture, and it gives something. It's a construction between the one and me, and it's fruitful.
And as you make a point in what you've written, you feel is best when first meeting the people you're working with to not introduce a translator because of all the complications of having another person present. And it's just you and the person. So when I hear you say, I know how to talk to people, I hear you meaning not just in words. You make it clear in your writing that your presence, your nonverbal presence, the mutuality of the body language, the, as we now learn, the foot massage, the fundamentals of our humanity, you are able to share with, receive from, and elevate into, as you call it, little freedoms. Little freedoms, such a wonderful phrase. You offer them through that little freedoms, which can change lives. Barbara, you have said many times in describing the challenge that it takes courage. You're referring on the one hand to the people who come to you and need courage to receive your presence, to receive your gift of little freedom, to tolerate it and to figure out how to be safe in their lives with it and perhaps how to pass it on to others. But of course, the courage is also your own. It is to take whatever your experiences were that made you attuned to suffering and to, as you say so beautifully, to turn death narcissism into loving engagement. And you've certainly done that with many people you've worked with. And I'm sure many of our listeners will feel elevated in knowing you and your work and your story as well. I want to thank you. Let me remind everybody both of your chapter and this book. Your chapter is called, again, 15 Years of Psychoanalytical Fieldwork in Eastern African Cities. And the book it is in is Trauma, Flight, and Migration, Psychoanalytic Perspectives. It is a treasure for anyone who really wants to understand the riches of psychoanalytic thinking as applied to venues that are very unusual but very precious. Read this book. It's filled with wisdom and it's filled with gracefulness such as yours, Barbara. I want to thank you for sharing this with me and us.
Thank you, Harvey. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.